session number 23195, Reel 4.
Mr. Bolton, Reel 4. We were talking about your time in the signal section of the RHQ of 68th Media Regiment when they were at Thorn in Yorkshire. What I wanted to look now is the way your duties in the signal office were rostered and what a typical day was like. Firstly, what was the organisation of a rota or roster or whatever?
Yes, the rosters varied according to the duty. The signal office was a straightforward one. It was actually an office job. So the signal office would open for the full day's work somewhere about 8 o'clock in the morning and would more or less shut down, except for skeleton staff, at perhaps 5 or 6 in the evening. And the staff who operated that normally did nothing else. That was their regular job.
So what would your daily routine be as a signal working the sort of normal shift?
Which I never did myself, except in emergency. But
what would you do then?
Well, I would be possibly operating my wireless. Once we were in action, of course, it all became much easier, but that's of course, going forward. While we were still training, there was no real need for the wireless sets, because the volume of message traffic, although quite considerable, the volume of paperwork, was dealt with largely by written communications and delivered by dispatch riders. Or it went over the telephone, which kept our lines busy, just maintaining the lines. And so the use of the wireless was largely created artificially to give us a bit of practice. And except when we went out on schemes, which we did fairly regularly, not much to do. Once we went out on the scheme, then of course that was quite different.
Well, tell me about the scheme. That'd be interesting,
right. So that was a field exercise for the entire RHQ, and just occasionally for the entire regiment, which we work on a sort of pre-drawn up plan of what the objectives were to be, to move to a certain location. Everybody to set up their different items, like the artillery would prepare their gun pits, or if they had time to dig pits, they would do that, and set themselves up and get themselves surveyed in, ready to open fire. We at RHQ would set up our different wireless links. On the wireless, my main preoccupation myself, The main links were forward to the two batteries, from RHQ to the batteries, passing forward instructions and occasionally fire orders. Although in actual practice, they nearly always got passed by telephone, because it was sort of easier and more certain, no interference. Anyway, that was what we were there for. So we had a forward link, which had the two batteries on the net, to us at RHQ. My job as an operator was to keep that net open. And once in action, it was 24 hours a day. We didn't do that while we were still in Thorn. It was never necessary, except on the said scheme. So on the scheme, we would practice real life, as it were. And we do, I think we did 4 hours on and 4 off, or 8 off. 4 on and 8 off, usually, I think. I find it hard to remember that now. Yeah. Anyway, we had the roster. In point of fact, when you're off duty, there wasn't much to do, so you were usually sitting around the wireless office anyway, and around the where you had your set.
Now, which wireless were you using? Do you remember which one it was?
It was a 21. I say that with my fingers crossed. Was it 21 or was it 22? How about I could forget that? I didn't know. But, I think it was 21.
Set?
Yes, but it was a very ordinary set. It was the set most widely used of all.
What controls did it have? Could you just describe it to us, as far as you can? I know, but I mean, what sort of variable controls did you have?
On-off volume and volume control. The most important one was the two dials in the middle. Now, one dial did the basic, which was tuning into the frequency, which was always pre-allotted. And frequencies came down from on high, from GHQ or brigade headquarters or whatever it might be, divisional headquarters, in batches they were allotted to you. Frequencies and call signs. We didn't call them a call sign, there was another name, right, which escapes me. I've forgotten that. Now, what was the wireless set like? What was the rest of it? Had other switches too. It was basically, I think, in two parts. One part handled the power, and that's the batteries were plugged into that section of it. And the other section, which was more or less attached to the first one, with a kind of steel grill over the front just to protect the controls from damage. I think both dials had something to do with frequency. One was a sort of coarse tuning, and then one went on to the other to fine tune. And we got a tuning signal, which we used to send out ourselves. I think one, having got the frequency as best one can, one was in control. We were in charge, so we ran the frequency, whatever frequency we adopted, which might even be slightly off, but it didn't matter, because we would send out a carrier note, it was called. I think you just pressed your microphone control and just sent a continuous noise, which came over as a sound at the other end. Now, it came out as high pitch. They had to tune it down until it got low pitch. It got too low and too loud, you went back to the middle again, and the idea was to find the middle bit where it was virtually silent. That was the correct pitch. And I always wondered, so when there was no message traffic being passed, and of course the first thing you did as soon as you opened up was to send out the tuning signal and then call the other stations. And we used to say, "Hello, Baker, Abel, Charlie, hear my signals, or report my signals. You repeat that once or twice, and then over to them, let go of your mic control and switch into listen, and then they would come back, "Hello, so-and-so," whatever your call number was, loud and clear, which is not what they said, actually. I've actually forgotten me.
It's a long time ago.
It may come back to me while we're talking. Mm. Anyway, I came back with a suitable report. Sometimes they'd ask you to repeat the tuning signal until they felt they were tuned in properly. Well, I think they sent us a sound also, and we could check their tuning. So it's a little bit of procedure just to tune in. That needed repeating, probably every 2 or 3 hours, because otherwise the thing would drift a little. And you could always tell when they were going off frequency, the voice became rather blurred, or you lost it altogether.
What about, we've mentioned the batteries before, but what about the aerials? Did you have to set up an aerial, did you do it?
Yeah, it was a very simple aerial. It was a rod aerial, consisted of several lengths of metal tubing, which got progressively thinner. It was only a thin rod anyway, which just pushed into a little mounting on the outside, which you had to put on the outside of your vehicle. And normally we were operating from a vehicle. Or if you took the wireless set out and put it in the hole in the ground, which we occasionally had to do later, then that followed you. You just stuck the aerial mounting in the ground and pushed in the various rods up to about 12 feet high. The more rod you had, the better. But you couldn't put it up too high, otherwise it just sort of flopped over. So it was probably about 12 feet. Now, if reception was poor, as it very often was, and I'll talk about that a bit more later, one could put up a so-called ground aerial, which was a larger and more robust set of rods, which probably had a diameter of about an inch and a half, again tapering off a bit. You push one in after the other. We used to go up to about 16 feet on that. And it also had an elaborate system of guy ropes, two levels, low and higher up a bit. Four guy ropes which you had to peg into the ground. The whole thing was complicated and took time to set up. It was extremely unpopular with us in the signals because A, it never improved reception. All it did was bring in more background noise. So it really didn't help. It was a useless exercise. Secondly, once we were in action, we were always uncomfortably aware of the fact that the enemy, if they saw a wireless aerial, would say, that's a British HQ. Let's give the Tommies what for. In practice, it never did happen, or very, very rarely, but that was always the thought in our minds.
The other equipment you had?
Oh, by the way, we had to do it because the RA officers demanded it because they wanted to get through. They had an urgent message, they had to go by radio. Then maybe we would report back to them we couldn't get through. They would say, can't you put up a bigger aerial? And there was no way we could avoid doing it. So we said, sure. Used to be forced to put it up. Well, it produced no better result.
What other equipment did you have for any purpose?
So we're talking about basically the wireless set. Excuse me. The accumulators to go with it. The charging equipment to charge up the accumulators. The linesmen operated their own line-laying trucks with rolls of cable, which didn't fall within our remit. Apart from that, we had the usual sort of trucks which any unit would have.
Which truck would you put your... would it be in?
A 1500 weight. which was normally just that, a 1500 weight van, very common in the army, with a top hole in, roof over at the back. And we had some sort of little frame inside, which was fitted in, to which we screwed the wireless, and some kind of simple frame on the floor which would take the batteries, so that thing all held together, and the radio on the aerial on the outside. Once we got into action, we were. I'll come to that in slightly more detail.
Yeah.
We got a better vehicle.
What do you remember about? I mean, you were at Thorn for quite a while, I presume. How often would you go out on these exercises?
Not often, although if one took quite simple training exercises, we used to set them up. Our own subaltern used to, our lieutenant, the signals officer, we called him, would set us up a little exercise sometimes, and we'd go out and drive around and practice, which might be about once a fortnight or once in 3 weeks.
What would you do normally? You know, I mean, when you weren't on the exercise, what were your sort of day-to-day routine duties? If you weren't sort of helping in the signals office...
The signals office was, in a sense, the best job. That went to the favourites of the signal sergeant, had one or two of his own favourite operators, always got that job. We were in two little groups that was formed automatically, as it were. One, the others like me, there were four or five of us who were youngsters, and then were two or three mature men. They tended to... we were all friendly together in a way, but, I mean, they tended to go their way and we went our ways off duty. We never went to the pub with them. And they always got the jobs in the signal office, which was the more respectable...
So what jobs would you get then?
I think the main thing was it was quite difficult to find work for us, because what could we do when there was no need for a regular wireless link? So we were put to work at cleaning up equipment, which is only a limited amount of work anyway. I think we spent a good deal of time doing very little, actually. It's universally known as skiving. Personally, I found that rather boring time, because I wanted a regular job, and it just wasn't there.
You'd not have rather been in the signal office.
Much rather, yes. Not only were the NCOs trying to find us work, I myself tried to do the same. We got put on fatigues, like cleaning vehicles. That was a good old favourite. Every vehicle got a regular rub down with a mixture of petrol and oil and a rag, which gave it a slight shine to the green paint. It's a boring job, which we rather resented, but we did that. We thought that was the job of the drivers. Well, that's another trade, by the way, driver. Royal Signals had its driving trade, but it had so many vehicles. So I cannot really remember, if you asked me to describe how a particular day went, it's quite difficult. Apart from the obvious things, we lined up before breakfast, I think. The more time went on, the fewer parades there were of that nature. By the time we got into action, they largely disappeared. I mean, it was some kind of parade at some point in the day, and we'd have a roll call. Then we just found our way down to the dining hall, because we were in these two isolated huts round the corner, down the road a bit from where the RHQ was, which also had the dining hall. So we spent a lot of time walking to and fro between the two. So we walked down there for our breakfast and then go back to our billets and tidy up and have a little bit of a parade.
What was the hut like? What was the hut like?
It's all right. We quite enjoyed it. Quite liked that. I think it had double bunks in it, so one up, one down. It did have some reasonable sort of heating, or if it didn't, we managed to contrive some. As I think you remember, we were always warm when it was cold. Otherwise, a fairly bare sort of, almost like a barrack room, well lit the windows, and had decent electric lighting. Had tables in the middle. It would sit on benches around the table and read the paper or do the crossword or argue the toss or whatever.
How did you get on with your fellow? I mean, you've said there were two groups, essentially, the older men and the younger, but how did you get on with the other two?
Once we all got to know each other from the earlier days, I got on very well with them. And I think my favourites really were the older ones, because I got on. They were more of my type, really. One or two of them were a little well-educated, which is not really the case with the operators. Apart from myself, I suppose I was well-educated, having been to a grammar school. I don't think any of the others had. So they were fairly rough and ready lot. We worked closely together, and they were good enough to accept my shortcomings as speaking too well or whatever. Did you, in fact, I disguised anyway, I'm sure.
Did you have any special pals, you know, that you...
Not, I think, there. I did later on.
What about the NCOs? What were they like, the signal sergeant?
We had two sergeants. One was a lance sergeant, that's right, slightly junior. He was in charge of the line section, and that was his sole preoccupation. So that was really regarded as quite an important part of the whole thing. nice chap. He was probably in his early 40s, so he was getting on. And he was a bit slow and a bit tubby. And then a married man, and much regretting he was away from his proper home life and stuck in this horrible job. It's a very common attitude, of course. Understandable. But he was pleasant enough, and... But we didn't have much to do with him. He looked after the line people. And the other chap was rather small chap, very sharp manner. His name was Chapman. We called him Chappie, but not, I think, to his face. He kept the discipline going. He was pretty good. He'd worked for the Gas, Light and Coke Company before call-out. And so he and I had something in common, I suppose, that kind of work. And I got on with him quite well. He was generally rather unpopular. No particular reason. He wasn't quite their type. And he was he was quite punctilious about passing on the orders from our lieutenant.
And what about your signal officer?
Didn't see much of him, really. He was billeted with the other officers. And so he would come around once a day. We might come to the morning parade. Might give us a lecture occasionally. But I didn't see a great deal of him.
Were you very aware of the other personnel, the normal officers, the colonel, the majors, and captains?
Not so much then. I'd say hardly at all. But it entirely changed once we were in action. So again, come to that.
Mm. Well, now we've just been talking off thing, and we've decided that you were at the Royal Signal Training Unit at Prestatyn probably until about May.
Right, yes, I think that probably was the case.
Mm. A bit longer than we said earlier, which does actually seem more reasonable. So you joined 68th Media round about May and then moved round about June to
I think
weren't attacked them long, were you?
No.
How did you get on with the civilians at Thorn? Did you have much contact with them?
No, I do not recall any contact other than the casual and going into shops or pubs and so on. I suppose pubs were probably represented the biggest area of contact. Mostly miners in that mining town, friendly characters. If you were elbow to elbow with one in the pub, he would start talking to you and you'd chat away.
They made you welcome when they saw you,
right.
But they didn't press themselves on you and you didn't.
That's right, we didn't press ourselves on them. But we did always end up in the kind of miners' hall. So the feature of towns in the north, it was a large, almost like a pub, but had a large room attached to it, with a stage and curtains. And sing-songs would be held here. In fact, the auditorium was just full of tables and chairs. So you took your beer in there. Well, in fact, there was a bar there too, I'm sure. So we would take our pints. And sit down there, and occasionally we would sit with the civilians, and always friendly. And there would be musical performances. Someone would play something, more usually they would sing something, usually something fairly ribald. So that was once a week, we used to do that, on a Friday. I don't know whether Friday was pay day, I'm not quite sure what day we got paid on in the army. I haven't mentioned that before. We had a weekly pay parade always, wherever you were, you had to be paid.
What was the pay parade like?
It was formal, very formal. So you were marched to some kind of office, or just a table and chair if you were in the open air later, or whatever it was. And there you stood in ranks, and your name was called out alphabetically. As your name was called out, you stepped smartly forward, took your cap off. Saluted, took your cap off, laid it in front of you. Your money was put into your cap, and you picked it up. I hope I'm right in saying this, but put it on again, put your hat on, saluted, turned about and marched off. I can't tell you whether we had to sign or not. I have a feeling we might have had to sign. But why I did it so often, I just no longer can remember the detail. But basically, it's the formality, I recall, the saluting. You had to salute twice.
What was your next move after Thorn?
We started going southwards. We became part of the enormous southerly stream of troops of every type and description, every type of unit, all going south, ready for the invasion.
Were you aware of the approach of the invasion, or D-Day as it was known? Did you know it was coming?
I think I'd have to say that officially we didn't. Nobody ever seemed to mention it. No officers ever talked about it. No one ever gave us a lecture on what would happen. Certainly not where we were going. It was strict and deadly secret, and we had no idea. Well, we knew roughly that we were going to France. And so we had the general. We knew as much as the enlightened public, as far as they were enlightened. So
what was your first move? Did you go south in stages, or...?
Yes, in stages, but quite quickly. Our first move was to go from Thorn in Yorkshire down to Wivenhoe, to a little village just outside Colchester. And it was an interesting journey. It was all the way. We were nose to tail with our own unit, and we were aware that behind us and in front of us were other units stretched on ad infinitum. An enormous volume of traffic, but hardly anything going in the opposite direction. And on the way, we passed over and over again by the side of the road, or just into little woods by the side of the road, great dumps of ammunition, with tarpaulins over it. Sometimes not even that, you could see what it was. And the whole way, we saw these dumps. Some idea of the incredible preparations for the invasion. And
what happened when you got to Wivenhoe? When would that be? March or
no? Much later. This is end of March. End of May. May. That's right.
It's
immediately prior to the invasion. This was the great move south, migration. All the army units came to the south. So that was the end of May. We were in there for a few days, during which I had one great stroke of good fortune. Some vital item of equipment was found to be wrong, faulty, and had to be replaced. And the admin said that we had to drive to an ordnance depot somewhere way out on the Great West Road, I think. And our sergeant, he was really very good on this one. He came up to me and another chap, because he knew we both lived in West London. He said, "Look, if you behave yourselves, you can go with us, go with the driver, and while he'll drop you off near your home, go and pick up the item, come back, meet you, as long as you adhere strictly to those arrangements and get back with him, you can have the day off," as it were. So that actually worked. That was a rare privilege, a rare treat. So we drove towards this West London depot, and on the way I said, "Drop me off here," and I had just a short walk from there, or perhaps a bus ride, but not far. I was actually able to go home, to the astonishment of my mother, and I think we managed to get hold of my dad as well, perhaps on the phone, and he came home, and I spent a couple of hours at home, which is really, really good. And then, of course, back again, back in time.
And then what happened?
So after that, let me draw my thoughts together.
I was going to ask is, did you have to do this business of waterproofing your vehicle?
Oh, yes, thank you for reminding me. That's most important. Yes, now, we did that. Yeah, I think we did that at Wivenhoe, this little place near Colchester.
Tell me, how did you do it?
It was done by the drivers. I never lifted a finger myself to do it, so I just watched what was going on. And it required enormous quantities of mastic, whatever, I suppose that's what it's called, mastic, sticky stuff like plasticine, which had to be put round every single joint and every single pipe and fitting into which water might conceivably get. And in addition to that, sort of sheets were wrapped round equipment, waterproof sheets. An extension pipe was put onto all the exhaust pipes so that the smoke, instead of going out horizontally, went up. That was quite important. But never having done it myself, I can't really give you a graphic account of that. We just
did they test them?
Oh, yes. We had to make sure. Of course, the important thing was, will the motor still start? To begin with, it never started, and they had to find out how to adjust their waterproofing so that it would start. And I'll tell you shortly about an incident where the motor wouldn't start because of the waterproofing, which held up the entire invasion. But yes, the waterproofing, that's right, was most important, and that was the drivers, in fact, have mostly gone off on a course. I think they've all been sent on a short course to do waterproofing, so they'd learned it, that was skill. So that was done there. And then We headed off from there, a fairly short journey, to the London docks. To Hackney Marsh, I think, to London itself. And about May, I can be fairly precise on dates now, I think May of the 5th, we made this short drive down onto the marshes, where there was a temporary camp had been set up, with tenting camp, simple catering facilities. And there we left our vehicles, which were then driven off by the drivers without anybody else. The entire vehicles were driven away down to the actual docks, and they were loaded onto a Liberty ship, which was going to take us across the channel. And we remained and spent the night there. There was a primitive naffy there, so it wasn't bad. And then the next morning, we had our breakfast. And then, somewhere about 10 o'clock in the morning, perhaps a little later, the loudspeaker, the public address system in the camp, started broadcasting on the BBC programmes. And then came the announcement from the BBC that Allied forces have today begun landing on the coast of France.
When you said May the 5th, you meant June.
June the 5th, sorry, that's right, June. Absolutely.
I knew you did, sorry.
Yes, June.
How did you react to the news of D-Day that it had gone?
Oh, great interest and some excitement. We thought that was a good thing, the last time it was going to happen. We were all intensely curious, except perhaps one or two had actually been, the older soldiers, particularly among the artillery, who'd come home via Dunkirk. They weren't so enthusiastic.
Were you nervous? I mean, because you were the first time in action, it would be. How did you feel in yourself?
It was a kind of exhilaration, really, rather than nervousness. In fact, looking back, I'm quite astonished at how casually we regarded all the dangers. Whatever was going to happen, which was unpleasant, was going to happen to someone else, of course. That was a time-honoured attitude. Everyone feels like that. We looked forward to it with some interest, and we were going abroad. Our first trip abroad, when you think of it. So it really was a time of great exhilaration and excitement, as I look back on it now. But that was just the 5th, and on the 6th during the morning, we heard that announcement, so we knew now it was happening. Then shortly afterwards, we were told to parade all our gear, and we were embussed, put on not our own lorries, which had gone off, but those specially supplied for the purpose. And we were driven to the docks.
Which docks? Tilbury or...?
Not Tilbury, no, it was London docks.
What type of ship did you board? Did you board the ship where your transport was already aboard?
Yes. The transport was loaded and gone into the bottoms of the holds. That includes all the guns and the gun tractors and all the entire range of vehicles, including the signals ones.
And all do you know loaded. The name of the ship or the number?
Yes, the Empire Trader, which is a standard Liberty ship. I think they were all called Empire something, a lot of them were. Mm-hmm.